We're about to talk once again with Jossie Ross, who is a member of both the Blackfeet Nation and Squamish, and he's a father, a writer, entrepreneur. He's an attorney, graduated from Columbia Law School, and now practices representing tribes with the Cromwell Law Office's Tribal Advocacy Group. And we're here to talk about his writing. He wrote two pieces that really caught my eye. One was, Is There a Problem? Racism, White Privilege, and Scary Brown Men. And the other one that I just read as we were preparing, Richard Sherman and the Problem of Being the Right Kind of Brown Man. And Jossie, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Mark. I appreciate it.
I appreciate you coming on. And let me start with, before we get into your analysis, which I really thought was so good at the end of both pieces, that I sent this article out to some people who don't quite understand the nature of the subtlety of privilege in our world. So mm-hmm. I'm using your article as a basis to create discussions. I'll let you know that.
Thank you.
Ahead of time.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
But let's start from the beginning. Just give our listeners both stories. What happened to you? Just a little sense of that, so they know where we're coming. Where you know where you're coming from with this. You can start with either one, Southwest or the courtroom, whatever you like.
Oh man, the Southwest one was, you know, one irritates me and one doesn't. The one in the courtroom was not a big deal to me. I just thought about it in the context of Richard Sherman. The one on the airplane was really a big deal in the sense that there was almost, you know, bad stuff happening. My blood was boiling. It still boils when I think about it. The context story is this. I was going over to New York. I went to school in New York. I went to law school in New York, and I've been fighting off for a while because I am a res boy. I live on the res. I stay here, and you know, there's been people that have been interested in me doing different television projects, and I'm interested to different degrees, but it has to add value. I don't want to do something just for the sake of doing it. And so, you know, these people, they're talking about a project that's really interesting. And it's coming right before Christmas. And wow, okay, this you know, I'm so interested that me, big little kid that loves Christmas still, I'm you know, likes to hang out with my son because he's on vacation, I'm going to take some time off and go to New York. And no big deal. It's a last-second flight. Television people do stuff last second. So they want me to come there. And I get terrible tickets because all the good tickets cost, you know, at that point, literally 2 days before the flight cost, you know, $900, $1,000.
Right.
I just don't have money like that to be spending discretionary. So I buy tickets on Southwest Airlines, and I've flown Southwest Airlines a million times. I previously represented tribes in California, so I'm used to flying. I fly, you know, at that point I was flying two times a week to San Francisco, San Diego, and to Sacramento. And so I fly all the time. It's not a big deal to me. And in fact, the romance is kind of worn off. Usually when I get on a flight, I don't have, in the words of Ed Norton on Fight Club, I don't have, you know, 30,000-mile friends. I don't, you know, I'm not mean, but I'm also not particularly endearing. I just get on the flight, say hi to everybody, and put on my headphones. And no big deal. I get on this flight, fly to Chicago, midway. And it's Chicago Midway or O'Hare, honestly, I don't even remember. But I go there, and now I have the short end of the flight coming up to New York. That's our flight. No big deal. Cool. I get on my flight, and because I bought my tickets last second, I'm one of the last people. I'm in the C boarding group. And anybody that doesn't know, Southwest Airlines just has boarding groups. It's social Darwinism, the cattle call. You know, they have the A, B, and C boarding groups. I'm in the C, so I'm getting the very, very last rung. It's a full flight. I get on the flight. There's a couple up front, and I realize at this point I only brought a little tiny bag, and I realize I'm going to get screwed on my bag. I mean, on my seats. I'm going to get a middle seat because it's a full flight, and I'm in the C boarding group. I look back, and there's not a whole lot to choose from back there. So if I'm going to get screwed, which I am, I'm going to get screwed up front. I'm going to get off the flight a little bit earlier. And so I make my way, and, you know, I ask the lady up front. There's a couple. They look like a couple. I assume they were a couple, and they had a baby. And they were sitting on either side of the middle seat. And I know the game. They have the, you know, their stuff in the middle seat, so they don't want anybody to sit there. And I understand that. And you know, I'm even sympathetic to that because they do have a baby. But at the same time, it's a full flight. I don't have a whole lot of options. And so I asked the lady, she, you know, I said, excuse me, is somebody sitting there? And she said, yes, I'm waiting for my friend. And I said, okay. You know, this is Southwest Airlines, no holding seats. But I said, okay, cool. And she said, and then she continued on, as liars often do. You know, she tells more of the story than she needs to. She said, I'm pretty sure she's getting on. And, you know, it's not a bus, right? It's not a it's not a subway. There's pretty much certainty if somebody's going to get on or not. You're going to know if your friend's getting on a flight or not. But, you know, I'm like, okay, all right. I'm pretty sure she's lying. But I'm going to wait right here because I don't have anything else to do. The flight's just filling up, and I'm going to get screwed on the seat anyway. People keep on getting on. The last few people in the seat boarding group get on. And then finally, literally the last lady, she was a white lady, and she literally grabs her and says, sit here. And like, oh, okay, you just kind of put it out there that you're lying. And I said, you weren't saving your seat for anybody. You didn't know that lady. And she said, she kind of turned away. I said, you realize how rude that was, right? And she said, that's not rude. All right, whatever. And so the other lady that she grabbed, she's like, nah. I mean, she didn't say this, but you could see it in her face. She didn't want anything to do with this. She's like, okay, I'm moving someplace else.
Let me go. Let me get out of here.
Yeah. And so, you know, I sit down. I sit down. And then the lady, you know, the guy, he was very, very chivalrous at first, the husband. Well, presumably the husband. I assume they were married. You know, they're white. Indians don't get married, but, you know. So he scoots over and gives me the aisle seat. Oh, that was very nice of you. Thank you. And I told him this. Thank you. And then she was facing the other way like a little kid, like on Dumb and Dumber when Lloyd was pointing at Harry, you know, trying to blame him for the pepper. It's like, I don't want him sitting here. She's pointing at me. And I turned, I said, you don't have any input on where I sit. And I'm not going to argue with the lady, Mark. I'm just not that. I wasn't raised like that. You don't, you know, men argue with men or men fight with men. I don't argue with ladies, but I'm going to correct her real quick. And then other than that, I'm not going to get involved because it's a woman. And, you know, that's just the way I was raised, right, right, wrong, and different.
Right.
You know, and so the guy, though, you know, and at that point, it's a done issue for me. I'm putting my headphones on. And the guy, all 5'5 of him, probably 130 pounds. Keep in mind, I'm 6'5, 240 pounds. And he tells me, he looks at me, he says, you need to shut your mouth. Oh. Now, here's the thing. I'm from a place called the Blackfeet Indian Reservation. I'm by way of the Suquamish Reservation. In these two places, you know, it, just like any other impoverished place, you grow up with a certain level I'll put it like this. We didn't sort out our differences by mediation at that time, you know, when I was growing up.
Right.
And so there's consequences. And I say that in a way, not to say like my area was tough or anything like that, but it's to say that I understand consequences. I'm a big guy. I'm 6'5", 240. But I understand that, you know, because of the way I grew up and, you know, playing sports with older kids, playing basketball, playing football, when you say something, you have to live with that something that you say.
Right, right.
And this guy, it was very apparent, had no idea of that notion.
I mean, the res, the street, are not that far away when it comes to that stuff. It's the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I mean, exactly.
Right.
And, you know, and so once again, it's not to say that it's so tough, but it's to say that I understand consequences. And I raised my son. I have a 7-year-old son, and he's raised with a very, very distinct knowledge of consequences, of cause and effect. Look, you can say whatever you want, you can do whatever you want, but you have to expect a reaction. Now, at that point, that's kind of where the privilege, I suppose, kind of starts to play in, is that I understood at that moment, because my adrenaline literally started pumping. I train. I do jujitsu. I grew up boxing. Like, at that moment, like, this guy, you know, he felt very, very at liberty to talk to me however he wanted. And so I'm trying to process this. Like, this wasn't that big an issue, but this guy, you know, says this in an aggressive tone. All right. And then I realized at that moment, and there was a guy, he was from India, or, you know, he's a Sikh. He had the head, you know, the headwear on, and you know, and he was over there, and he was mouthing. He was like, it's not worth it. not worth it. Because he heard what the guy said, and his eyes bugged out of his head too. And I'm okay, all right. And I realized at that moment, that was the first instance of the privilege on that plane, was that if I respond to that, then inherently I'm the person that's wrong. Because first of all, that's kind of big, you know, like I'm a big person. And so, you know, that thing right there, I look like the aggressor.
Right.
Okay. So I, you know, and I leaned in and I said, you realize this flight is going to end at some point, right? And, you know, and I was trying to, you know, I was literally trying to unclench my fist. And then at that moment, the captain, or I assume he was the captain, he looked like the captain, you know, he had the white dress shirt on, you know, stuff like that. And he came out of the captain's area. I don't know how they have it, pilot, co-pilot, whatever. But he was one of those guys that's in that room. And he comes out, and I'm happy because I wanted somebody to mediate at that point. I'm not a snitch. I come from a community that I, you know, that's what we call them, the snitches. And so I don't want to be the tattletale. But at this point, I realize that it could be have bad consequences for me, and I'm just not trying to get involved like that. And so I have a big meeting the next day, and so you know I just want to get on. I just want to get on with my flight and get to New York. And the captain, who I assume is the captain, comes out. He says, is there a problem? And I start immediately, you know, little kid response. I start telling him, you know, tattling. Well, yeah, look, this lady, you know, she said this, and then I said this, and then he said this, and then he said, well, the only person I hear is you. And okay. All right. And then he's immediately, and you know, I filed a formal complaint with Southwest Airlines, et cetera, et cetera. And they responded back. They said, as you know, the captain said, asked you or several times if there was a problem before he asked you if you wanted to get on a flight. That was a lie. The next thing he said was, do you want to take the next flight? And I didn't even realize that was a consideration. Like, I didn't realize we were talking about next flights. Where did that come from? And, you know, I honestly, you know, I was at that point of I didn't expect that, Mark. I didn't expect that sort of thing. And, okay, I get it. And that's when the racialized me, the critical thinking me, understands, okay, I recognize this content. I recognize exactly what you're doing. You understand what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
This is a situation, yeah, my mom, my dad, you know, they told me about this. I've experienced this before, but now I've been the fancy lawyer for a little while, and I don't have to experience this as often because people don't see me. I'm on the plane in camouflage pants. I'm not looking like lawyer guy Jossie. And, you know, it's a different context. Okay, I see what you're doing. It's like when the cops would come by and, you know, you're in your car, and for no particular reason, they flash the lights in your car because you're driving a nice car. It's that, you know, and so I recognize it. Okay, I see where we are. And then I told him, well, I suggest that you have selective hearing. And then his words were, oh, now you want to get in my face. And once again, now I'm putting on the critical thinking lens. And I, you know, from that perspective, I'm thinking, well, whose face did I get in initially? But then I realized because of what he's doing, that he's looking from this lens of, you know, this racialized lens, that I can't continue on this conversation. I have to stop it because he's the power broker. He's at the point of asserting his authority, and I have to either make a decision that either I have to acquiesce to his power, and in that instance, I had to because I have that meeting the next day, and that was important. That's the whole reason for the flight. And so I can frustrate the purpose of the flight and perhaps win a moral victory, but I don't get anything out of it. Or alternatively, I can truly answer the way I want to, but at that point, you know, it's futile because then I'm on a flight going to New York, the next flight, for no particular reason. I'm just going there because that meeting is canceled. And so, you know, it was frustrating. It was really, really humiliating. And, you know, I understand, you know, the captain or the guy who looked like the captain, you know, his job, I don't necessarily think, you know, and in the article, I try to make this delineation very clear. I do not think that he was a racist. I have no grounds whatsoever to say he was a racist. That would be a lie. That would be presumptuous. I do, however, know what he was doing, and that was asserting authority against a man of color, and specifically a large man of color, because he could, number one, but number two, because he saw two people, the two white people who he saw as victims in this particular exchange. And he didn't ask any questions. After the flight, two guys, and there was a town, I didn't know there was a town, I almost went to the University of Stony Brook.
Long Island.
Yeah, I almost went to school there, and so I'm pretty familiar with Long Island. But this guy came up to me afterwards, and he says, you know, he's like, oh, man, that's BS. I'm not going to curse on your show. But he's like, man, that's BS how that happened. And I said, you know, and I said, oh, well, thank you. He said, yeah, I told the captain exactly. It happened exactly like you said, that the lady started provoking you and that the guy told you to shut your mouth. And he told me he's from Hicksville, Long Island. I didn't know there was a town called Hicksville, Long Island.
I thought you were joking when you wrote that in the thing, but no.
No, there really is a town called Hicksville, Long Island. I thought he was joking. But, you know, he told the captain afterwards. And, you know, the thing was that I don't mind. Everybody makes assumptions. Everybody has prejudices. I don't mind. I do as well. People of color do. Poor people do. Large people do. It doesn't matter. That's irrespective of class, size, color. But the difference is that most people, and I try to put myself into this category, Mark, most people take the time to ask the question whether or not their prejudice is correct. You understand what I mean? They challenge it.
You think most people do that?
I think so. I mean, I think you're forced to in this day and age. Well, it's generally at least go through, you know, there's in law, there's different kinds of due process. There's procedural due process and there's substantive due process. I think most people give procedural due process. That is that they want to at least say that they checked off the checklist to show that they did the right thing. I'm not saying that it was a meaningful experience. You know, so for example, I was recently, you know, talking about television shows. I was recently given the opportunity to ponder a television show by a production company that I won't name. And immediately when I heard about the body of work that the production company did, it was some reality shows, and a lot of them were train wreck reality shows. And so my alerts went up. Now, when we had our discussions, I definitely did the procedural due process. That is, I checked them out. I listened to them. I did all the stuff to say that, yes, we had a fair discussion. But in the back of my mind still lingered this doubt. But I could say on paper that absolutely I did what I was supposed to do, my due diligence. And I think most people do that. They have to cover their bases because most things are so transparent, captured on video or, you know, different things like that. So I think people have to a degree.
Well, a couple of things hit me about what you wrote here, and I think I really want to get into some of this. One of the things you and I was thinking a couple steps back in the conversation when you talked about what happened to you on the plane and what people of color, especially men, confront all the time. And you when authority figures look at somebody who is black or brown or is a man, and because they're black or brown, appear threatening to the rest of the world.
Yeah,
that what you said was that you wrote about it, and you said here on the air that you're presumed guilty before even you open your mouth, and you wrote, which leads brothers and sisters and mothers and aunts beat down, pepper sprayed, thrown in jail for choosing to answer the question honestly instead of swallowing their tongue, and it's the language that's used when people are stopped that starts creating a confrontation. Because people's pride gets welled up and they stand up.
Absolutely.
And that's the not-so-subtle part on one level, right?
Yeah.
I mean, when you were on the show last, you talked about all the Indian kids that you know that whose murders were never solved.
Yeah. No, it's, you know, the thing is that, and, you know, I invoked, and obviously it was much less serious consequences, but I invoked the name of Trayvon Martin in this particular instance. I still, after the trial, you know, et cetera, the Trayvon Martin trial, I don't think George Zimmerman was a racist. But I think he had that presumption of guilt that 99%, including people of color, mind you. Mm-hmm. You know, people of color are not immune from that as well. That, you know, that people of color and everybody else, think that big or maybe not even big, but brown men, black men are always up to something. And so, you know, in this particular instance, Yeah, I mean, you know, that's always the question that we're confronted with is, are we going to swallow our pride, or are we going to make this a bigger deal? Now, that sounds very, very simple because, yeah, of course, why would you want to make it a big deal? But that's the privilege part, is that this young couple that I was talking to that you know, in my estimation, escalated the whole experience, they didn't have to contemplate that.
I'm talking with Jossie Ross, writer, attorney, and member of the Blackfeet Nation. There's much more to this conversation with Jossie Ross coming up right after this break. You don't want to miss it. Stay with us. On our way to break, you're hearing Memories of You by U.B. Blake, born on this day in 1883. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. The corner of Chestnut and Low, one of the great songs written by U.B. Blake. We play that today to celebrate his birthday. Born in Baltimore on this day in 1883. We're about to talk once again with Jossie Ross, who is a member of both the Blackfeet Nation and Squamish, and he's a father, a writer, entrepreneur. He's an attorney, graduate from Columbia Law School, and now practices representing tribes with the Cromwell Law Office's Tribal Advocacy Group. And one of the words you use and you hear a lot is how you kind of how those more aggressive pieces are addressed. Is there a problem?
Yeah.
Right.
And
that's the kind of stuff that kind of heightens the tension, because
yeah,
that's what it's meant to do, whether it is conscious or unconscious.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, you know, once again, the delineation between privilege and racism is very, very important, because it's not that, and I wrote a piece that you referenced, the Richard Sherman piece, and that
right.
was in Gawker, this past week. And, you know, it's got a huge reaction, and largely the reaction, you know, people, this is largely a true statement that those, and this is empirical, the people, it's gotten a huge negative response in there, the comments, and because in pop culture, we're trained not to bring up, to address the, you know, 800-pound gorilla of race. We're not supposed to talk about it. Every time we talk about it, it's playing the race card. Even when you talk about it in the context of making an observation, everybody will give every single possible explanation why something is not related to race. So, for example, when the comments to this "Is There a Problem?" piece, the Southwest Airlines piece, somebody wrote in there, just gave you the same body of facts that I gave you a couple minutes ago, and somebody commented back, said, "Well, look, there's a flight full of seats, and you choose to sit in the middle of this couple, and that's just not a nice thing to do," and blah blah blah. No, it was a full flight. You're trying to make the facts fit your prejudice so that you don't have to discuss race. So you can, you know, it's regression analysis. So you can eliminate every single thing. And that's what the expectation is, that empirically we have to be able to eliminate every single possible explanation except for race. And then if there's, you know, if in the instance of Trayvon Martin or any of these particular instances, that's the only time we can do it, is by eliminating every other single possible explanation. And there's a Occam's razor. Have you ever heard about that?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, you know, for me, I'm not the smartest person in the world, but at some point, if I start to notice a certain pattern or a certain trajectory to narratives, look, I recognize patterns. And, you know, if I notice it frequently enough, even not being the smartest person in the world, I'm going to say, oh, okay, yeah, I've seen this situation before. I see it. I recognize it, just like I did on the plane. I recognized it more with the captain. I wasn't worried. Southwest Airlines couldn't do anything about these two passengers. They just happened to be not nice people. They could do whatever they want. But the fact that the pilot came out and focused all of his attention upon me without bothering to ascertain any other facts, to me, that stinks. That's something that he should absolutely be sensitive to and at least try to eliminate, do a little bit of fact-finding to see if there's something else there. If not, you're putting that presumption upon me to prove myself, prove to my, to prove myself that I'm not doing something wrong.
And one of the things, though, I mean, this, in terms of the where we've come to in America, the subtlety of white privilege or systemic racism and how those things interact is where we're living now. You talk about the woman who you actually met at a party later and had a nice conversation with, who was a lawyer in a court when you walked in the room, your first case, and yeah. She walked up to you and seeing this big guy, are you looking for your lawyer or something like that, right?
Right.
And so so that happens, but then you kind of took that story and talked about what happened to Richard Sherman.
Yeah.
And saying, so he's an acceptable Indian. He's an acceptable Negro because he went to Stanford or he went to Columbia.
That's right.
You know, and so you might be excused.
Yeah, right, maybe. Right. No, you're different. And, you know, it's interesting because that's something I'm sure Richard Sherman, that's not the first time he's heard that. That's certainly not the first time I've heard that. You know, that's one of the things that I give a lot of speeches at graduations and stuff. And so just really quickly, the story for the listeners, the story is this. And this is, mind you, one that doesn't make me mad. This one was actually funny. And I thought the girl was charming and sweet. And I wasn't mad at her at all. I think it was an honest, you know, she wore it on her sleeve unabashedly. You know, and it's, sometimes things happen. Everybody has prejudices, but she wasn't somebody that I felt like was trying to manipulate as a result of that privilege that she experienced. And the story is this, that I was getting ready for my first jury trial in Seattle as a public defender, and I was going to, as I did when I used to play basketball, I would go to the basketball court beforehand and visualize the game. Here I went to the courtroom and I was visualizing the courtroom. I'm going to make the arguments like this. I'm going to make my dramatic cross like that. And I'm going to stand up to the jury. And, you know, and I was visualizing everything. And I had my suit on. I had my hair in braids. I was looking sharp, no earrings on, conservative, you know, clean shaven. I had my first new suit. Up until that point, I bought every single suit I had at a thrift store and got it altered. This was my first new suit. I was looking sharp. I felt good. And I was up there, I had a piece of paper in my hand, little steno notebook, and, you know, I had my cross questions, I was getting ready, and this little young white lady, and turns out she was the prosecutor, but she comes inside and she smiles at me first. I didn't just get right to the conversation, she smiled at me first, and I smiled at her. She was cute, you know, why not? And, you know, I thought maybe she was impressed by the new suit. And she comes in and she smiles at me, and there was a pause, and I didn't really want to continue on with my questions because she's going to think I'm a crazy person. But I, you know, and she looks at me and she says, "Excuse me, sir, are you waiting for your attorney?" And I smiled because I honestly didn't feel like she had any malicious intent, Mark. She wasn't somebody that was trying to demean me or make me feel less than a human being. It was an honest question. And that's the part of the privilege, is that it is an honest question. You know, if it had been anybody else, you know, if it had been, and it's counterfactual, of course, but if it had been a white boy in a new suit looking sharp with a steno notebook in his hand in an empty courtroom, I don't think too many people would assume that's a criminal defendant.
I don't think so.
Yeah. And you know, and so that's exactly the point, is that it is, you know, it was good intent. She wasn't trying to be humiliating to me. And that's why I didn't lash out at her. I didn't say anything. I said, yes, I am. And I smiled at her. And later on, yeah, the story went on later on at a party. You know, the Seattle legal world is very small, just like most towns' legal world is very small. And we were at a party, and one of the guys that I played basketball with, who also happens to be a defender, he introduced me to her, and she was there, and she was blushing. She was really, really embarrassed. And, you know, she was, and you know, we kind of recounted the story, and my lawyer friend, he laughed, and he laughed and he said, oh man, you happen to get the one guy, the one Indian guy, ask him if he's a defendant who happens to be a lawyer from Columbia Law School. And I thought, you know, and I was like, and I laughed too, because it was funny. But then when I thought about it in the context of the Richard Sherman instance, where people who came to his defense said, well, look, you're calling him a thug, but did you know that he went to Stanford and graduated, does all this work in the community, he's never been involved with any sort of disciplinary action by the NFL, and he had one instance of a disciplinary action, and that people thought he was using a controlled substance, but he cleared his name, he was admonished, all that. I mean, he all that stuff was, you know, they give his bona fides, his list of bona fides, and so when I thought about that instance in the courtroom in the context of Richard Sherman, to me, it's an understandable instinct. The people, my friend who made the comments about me and talking about me going to Columbia, he didn't mean it in any sort of way. And in the same way, the people that are defending Richard Sherman, they're not meaning it in a bad way, in a disrespectful way. They're earnestly trying to speak to this guy and humanize him. But when I wrote it, I thought about this quote by James Baldwin in the Fire Next Time, when he was talking about his white friends to Elijah Muhammad. You're trying to humanize somebody that should already be human. Right?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, right. You know, my friends shouldn't have to humanize me. Nobody should have to humanize Richard Sherman. We should already be human. But that's the instance, that's the example of white privilege. It's not a racist thing. It's just a thing that for many people, we're still trying to get to the point of not being looked at as characters or of archetypes. He's the Indian guy. No, he's Jossi. He happens to be blah, 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 blah. No, that's not a black football player. That's Richard Sherman. You understand what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so that's the part that, you know, and it's not necessarily anybody's fault, because once again, we all fall victim to that. I fall victim to that. But I'm just saying that it's indicative of that structure of white privilege, where most white folks who are inside of a, you know, what's the guy's name? He played for New England for a long time. Really, really dirty ball player. He played for Denver. Romanowski.
Okay, yeah, right.
Romanowski. I mean, he was the worst possible player. He sounded like a terrible guy. He really did, you know, from the way he played football. Having said that, I didn't hear people go to his list of bona fides to try to humanize him.
Right.
You know, when Lance Armstrong was struck, and this, we're talking about criminal stuff here. We're talking about criminal stuff. We're talking about perjury, and we're talking about, you know, using controlled substances, convicted, admitted. People didn't have to, you know, go to this level of singing his bona fides and all the stuff he does in the community before they accepted him back in. Now, granted, he kind of made his, you know, his bed with in regards to other things, because he was very arrogant about the situation. But when you contrast that with Richard Sherman, who literally, Mark, did nothing wrong, but yet we have to invoke the names of Romanowski and Lance Armstrong and other people to find comparable behavior, because what he did, we have to humanize him.
Racism and the issues around race have become subtle. Do you know what I'm saying?
You
have to pull them out, because most people go, what? Wait a minute, that's not racist.
Right.
You know, he went to Columbia. I don't even think bad by that.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It's an unconscious thing, and that the way you have to figure out how to kind of address that, confront it, and talk about it, I think is one of the critical issues.
Right. Yeah, and you know, and it's interesting, because that whole structure has changed. You know, when you think about, at one point, it was very, very easy to address something that, you know, people saw as racist. Now, you were dealing with specific behavior, and now you're not dealing with behaviors, you're dealing with outcomes, because it's all residue. And so as a result of that, so for example, with voting rights cases, right? I mean, there was the big voting rights case in Texas this year. And, you know, there's empirically, it has to be proven over such a long span of time that by the time that behavior gets identified and hopefully diagnosed and treated, it's moot, because that behavior has changed. People say, oh, okay, well, they're on to us. and you know, you look through the, you know, any particular voting rights case, you have to show such a pattern of systematic turning away or deterring people of color's votes or different language groups' votes in order to be able to prove it up. And it's almost become an unprovable thing these days. And we all know it still exists, but it's that little specter, it's that itch that you can't find, And that's, you know, sort of what's frustrating is that there's still, you know, a lot of work to be done and there's still a lot of discussions to be had. But going back to this comment section on Gawker, or not just to, you know, pick on me, I'm not special. But anytime somebody brings up the specter of race, people say, oh, well, that's so 20th century. You know, that's something that we don't talk about anymore, mm-hmm. but it's still there.
Well, Joshua Ross, I really appreciate what you write and your way of putting it and your creative way of thinking and speaking and bringing all these issues out for us. And I thank you so much for taking time with us here on the Mark Steiner Show.
Absolutely. Can I plug my book?
No, man, you can't.
Can I please? Pretty please.
Yeah, I do plug the book, please. Yes.
Do. Okay, I have a book called it's called How to Say I Love You in Indian. It's my new book, my second book. And it's on Amazon.com or Cut Bank Creek, I speak like a Montanan, CutBankCreek.com, CutBankCreekPress.com, or Amazon, How to Say I Love You in Indian. And it's a beautiful book. It doesn't talk about race. It talks about love and flowers and all kinds of stuff like that. My son a whole bunch. I end up writing about him.
And I see you have his picture there. How do I say I Love You in Indian?
That's right.
That's his picture, right?
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, he's a cool kid.
So we will have you back on just to talk about that book.
Absolutely.
All right.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you for everything.
Thank you, Jossie.